Bruce Edwards, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. 2 years after 195 countries came together under the Paris Agreement to combat the effects of climate change, world-renowned climate economist Nicholas Stern remains cautiously optimistic.
In a sense, the world passed the test. The challenge came down. The world said, we'll get on with it. So I'm very optimistic about what we can do. I worry about whether we've got the political decision-making capacity to get on with it at the pace we need.
In his landmark report on the impact of climate change, published in 2006, Nicholas Stern warned that the cost of inaction would be far greater for future generations than the costs of actions taken to reduce carbon emissions. The study was quickly recognized as the definitive account of the economic dangers posed to the planet by global warming. Nicholas Stern is professor of economics and government at the London School of Economics and joined a panel discussion on the economic and financial issues related to climate change at the IMF World Bank annual meetings. So, your report back in 2006 on the impact of climate change laid out very clearly the economic implications. Should we not reduce our dependence on fossil fuels? So 11 years later, where do we stand?
I think we know quite a lot more. We know that the risks which the science pointed us to 11 years ago now look even tougher than they did then. Greenhouse gases have gone on rising quite strongly, so concentrations have gone up. That's what traps the heat. And a lot of the things have come through more quickly than we anticipated, whether it's the retreat of ice, the collapse of the coral, the intensity of the hurricanes, and so on. That's come through rather more quickly than we thought then. So the science looks more worrying. On the other hand, some of the technical progress has been quite remarkable. I mean, the cost of a solar panel is one-tenth or less than one-tenth what it was then. I don't think we predicted that. We wouldn't have anticipated that the presidents of the big motor companies would be talking about the end of the era of the internal combustion engine. I don't think we would have anticipated that cities and countries around the world would say, you know, no internal combustion engine after 2030 or 2040 in sales, or hydrocarbon-using cars can't come into our city centres 5 or 6 years from now. So I don't think we anticipated the technical progress in power generation. I don't think we anticipated the technical progress in transport. It's come through very fast. And it shows that human ingenuity, if there's something to focus on, will focus and discover things in ways that surprise. So the risks are more worrying than we thought, but the alternatives look much more attractive, not only because the costs have gone down, but what we're starting to see is that there's a growing understanding of the costs of pollution as well.
You mentioned, technology, the advent of technology, it's moving very rapidly. And there are a lot of entrepreneurs and young entrepreneurs that recognize, you know, the potential business opportunities, especially in developing countries, by innovating, finding alternative ways of doing things. Do you think that we do, governments and international financial institutions do enough to sort of encourage that activity?
Probably not enough. Mm. There's good economics behind encouraging taxation of carbon, because you are doing damage to other people for nothing if that is not taxed. And that, of course, means you do too much of it. There's very good economics about fostering research and development, because if we discover things, ideas are generally available to everybody. So people who discover, even people who do failed experiments, give people knowledge that's very useful. And so there's a gain from that activity, which is not fully captured by the people who do it. And in the case of climate change, where we're in a real hurry, because if we wait, delay is very dangerous. You lock in high carbon infrastructure, and of course the flows of the greenhouse gases raise the concentration, so life becomes more and more difficult if you delay. So R&D in this area is very important because delay is dangerous, and the use of the discoveries helps everybody in a direct way because it reduces greenhouse gas emissions. So we should be encouraging strongly research and development. There is some there. You have subsidies for renewables. I think it would be better to focus on taxing the bads and putting strong resources into discovery. And we've done pretty well. I think we could do much better.
And so how much of this issue is still about trying to convince policymakers and world leaders that this problem is caused by humans? Why is this still part of the debate, and how does it affect our ability to solve this issue?
I think the understanding that greenhouse gases trap infrared energy, basic physics, it's been built up over a couple of hundred years. I think that understanding is pretty widespread. There are not many places in the world where there is serious attack on the science. There shouldn't be. I mean, if somebody has discovered something that overturns 200 years of climate science, they should jolly well publish it. Of course, they don't, because they haven't got that evidence. So I think the understanding of the basic science has improved a great deal. And there are a few places, you know, some parts of the USA, but not much of the world where the science is seriously contested. The problem in political decision-making is that people don't see this as pressing them very hard now. So actually, because delay is so dangerous, action should really happen very quickly. But that action is reaping benefits 30, 40, 50 years from now. And the action that we need to take actually is very attractive action. I mean, cities where we can move and breathe seems like a good idea, even if you've never heard of climate change. But some of it has to be fairly radical action. You know, we have to move quickly. We have to change our cities quickly. We have to change our modes of transport quickly. So it's not that it's unattractive. It's very attractive, but it's radical, and there's some dislocation. And I think getting political decision-making to move in a strong way with some dislocation, even though the results are very attractive, when much of the benefit is down the track, can be quite difficult. And I think what we're beginning to realize is the demonstration that a lot of the benefit comes through quickly is a crucial part of the argument, in particular pollution and congestion. Those benefits come through pretty quickly. That, I think, will help us win the political argument for more speedy action. But it's of enormous importance that we do win that argument.
And so how much time do you think we have? I mean, I've heard you say before that the next 20 years are going to be critical. Do you think that we can shift to clean energy in the next 20 years? And what does that mean for, you know, infrastructure in terms of, you know, our infrastructure needs between now and then? Do we start building networks for electric cars, or do we continue building them the way that we have been?
Let's understand why the next 20 years are so important. The world economy will probably roughly double in that next two decades. Doesn't matter for this argument whether it's 18 years or 28 years. I mean, roughly double in the next two decades. And infrastructure will much more than double, because many countries are going through urbanization very strongly. Many countries are building their transport and their energy and their water systems in a strong way. So infrastructure will more than double. In the next 20 years, we need to cut our emissions absolutely by around 20% to have a reasonable chance of holding well below 2 degrees, which is the agreed international target. So you're going to double the infrastructure, more than, next 20 years. At the same time, you've got to cut emissions, and that's by 20% or so. And that's a measure of how strong the change has to be. It means, of course, that if we have to cut by 20% in the next 20 years, we have to peak pretty soon, within the next few years. But actually, emissions around the world from energy have been fairly static over the last 2-3 years. China peaked its coal 3 years ago. So it looks as if we might be able to peak total world emissions within the next 4 or 5 years. But it's going to need strong action. It's going to need far-sighted action. It's going to need the building now of the networks for electric cars, for cycle lanes, to improve facilities for pedestrians. It's going to need insulation of homes and offices. It's going to need buildings designed to generate electricity as well as to use rather little of it. All those things have to be pushed strongly now. Hugely beneficial. We'll be much more efficient, much less polluted. We'll be growing more quickly. But those changes have to be strong and radical. So we need that decision making, and we need it now.
So a couple of years ago, when the Paris Agreement was signed, I read that you were very encouraged by that. How do you feel about the Paris Agreement now? I mean, the politics looks like may well compromise it somewhat. Are you still optimistic?
I think the Paris Agreement was a landmark, and 195 countries got together and they agreed to work to tackle a problem where the consequences and the difficulties were down the track. Contrast that with the end of the Second World War and the decision to set up the multilateral institutions, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, United Nations, the beginning of the European Community. That was after 3 decades with 2 world wars and the Great Depression. The recognition that you had to do much better at collaborating with each other was surely something that was pretty obvious. It's necessary. But on this one, 195 countries looked ahead. They saw the problems and they said, this is how we're going to deal with them. So I thought Paris was remarkable, remarkable in people coming together in this clear and strong way. The Paris came into force very quickly because ratification came through within 10 months and it came into force after 11 months. The Kyoto Agreement took something like 7 years. Mm-hmm. So it moved quickly. It moved quickly. And country after country, after the election of President Trump, when everyone knew that his views on climate change were, you know, somewhat skeptical, said, look, we get on with it because it's the right thing to do. The alternative growth path is attractive. We have to do it. We like what we see. We get on with it. And in a sense, the world passed the test. The challenge came down. The world said, we'll get on. We'll get on with it. So I'm very optimistic about what we can do. I worry about whether we've got the political decision-making capacity to get on with it at the pace we need. There's a chance that we will, but it does need strong, clear arguments and advocacy to bring those decisions that we need about.
That was Nicholas Stern, Professor of Economics and Government at the London School of Economics and Chairman of its Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. You can watch the webcast of the IMF World Bank Annual Meeting Seminar on the economic and financial issues related to the impact of climate change at imf.org. And if you like this podcast, subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. And you can also now follow us on Twitter at IMF Podcast.